And welcome back to Coast AM. Adolf Hitler was the dictator of Germany from 1934 to 1945. His dramatic oratory captured the minds of Germans.
Als unsere Partei gerade 7 Mann hoch war, sprach sie schon 2 Grundsätze aus. Erstens, sie wollte eine wahrhaftige Weltanschauungspartei sein. Und zweitens, sie wollte daher kompromisslos die einzige Macht und alleinige Macht in Deutschland.
Fiery.
In the final days of the war, during the Battle of Berlin in 1945, Hitler apparently married his longtime partner, Eva Braun. On the 30th of April 1945, less than 2 days later, the two committed suicide to avoid capture by the Red Army, and their corpses were burned. Or were they? In a moment, the compelling evidence that Hitler survived. Hunting Hitler with Jerome Corsi. Welcome back to Coast. Jerome Corsi with us, of course, received his PhD from Harvard University. He was just on with me during the Kennedy assassination period with his work, Who Really Killed Kennedy? And he was telling us at that time that he had a new one coming out, Hunting Hitler, the scientific evidence that Hitler escaped Nazi Germany. This is a compelling story. It truly is something that I think Jerry's going to go all around the planet. But welcome back to Coast, Mr. Corsi.
George, it's great to be back with you. Thank you very much.
For many people who were not born during World War II or have dabbled in past history, let's go way back to Hitler's era. Now, there was a time where he was arrested and put in jail before he made it to power, correct?
That's correct. From about 1923, right after a putsch attempt to really have a coup d'etat to take over the government, a beer hall putsch in which in Munich, in which Hitler and a group of the early Nazis marched out and thought they were going to take over the city and have a revolution that would overturn the government. They were all arrested. Some were shot. Hitler went to prison.
So he goes to prison. He gets out. He starts into what he was doing again, eventually becomes Chancellor of Germany, and then he becomes the Führer, the dictator.
That's right. In prison, he wrote Mein Kampf, which became his great statement of hatred and determination to have a world war. When it was first published, it was considered to be an insane book, but over time, it became the Bible of the Nazi movement. And Hitler, in a very unpredictable way, I mean, to look at who Hitler was and the Nazi Party to begin with, you never would think that they would have risen to power. But yet, Hitler did, with these fiery speeches and the captivating the imagination of the German people, Hitler became dictator in 1933, becoming Chancellor of Germany and having really absolute power over the German government.
What possessed him to go in the direction that he went, Jerry?
Well, I think that's going to be one of the enduring questions of history, George, is the mystery that is Adolf Hitler, this almost insane hatred of Jews, the determination to eradicate all Jews in Europe, the vision of Germany dominating Europe and the resentment over World War I and the repayments that had been demanded by the Versailles Treaty, where Germany was making reparations to the Allied powers in World War I, all these elements combined in a almost psychological mix that happened to appeal to the German population coming out of losing World War I very unexpectedly, having to go through the Depression, suffering economically, and then here comes this almost messianic figure, Adolf Hitler, promising to rise like a phoenix with Germany leading the world, and he captivated not only the imagination of Germans, but the imagination of people worldwide.
Including in the United States.
Yes, and this is one of the great stories I think I really get into in Hunting Hitler, is that Hitler was funded in the United States by Wall Street. Wall Street funded Hitler's rise to power.
What did they like about him, Jerry? What did they see in order to do that?
In the initial phase when Hitler came on the scene, as well as Mussolini, and this fascist movement sweeping the world, looked, George, like it was going to be the resurgence of an industrial era in which through building businesses, these two German and Italian leaders would bring Europe into a new renaissance. And the idea was that the Depression, which through the 30s had worldwide depressed economies, was going to be over. It was a great dream, and Wall Street enthusiastically supported the industrialists who were ready to rebuild Germany.
So, you know, they pumped money into Hitler, and there's no question German technology was taking off. I mean, they were in the rocketry. The German cars are phenomenal. They were really making headway, weren't they?
Yes, they were, George. And it's really one of the, again, remarkable stories of World War II is that, of course, the German nations always had a reputation for excellence in manufacturing and precision manufacturing, advanced technology. But certainly with the oncoming of World War II, I mean, the automobiles, Hitler was copying Henry Ford and producing a Volkswagen, a people's car. It was designed, that car was designed by Hitler and Goebbels. And they basically, and by, the entire German hierarchy got into figuring out how they could produce this automobile. And then the airplanes, the phenomenal Luftwaffe, and the idea that Germany would have this advanced air force coming out of World War One, rocketry, early rocketry. Mm-hmm. Hitler was the first to really have the scientists, the German scientists, who were understanding the secrets of the atom and realizing that you could, in fact, have a nuclear, atomic bomb. It was doable. Many of these scientists were Jews, and they fled Europe because of Hitler's persecution of the Jews. Had the Jewish scientists stayed in Germany, I don't think there's any doubt Hitler would have been the first to have the atomic bomb.
And he would have used it.
Oh, no question about it. The V-2 rocket that Wernher von Braun was developing was the first ballistic missile, and it was designed to carry an atomic weapon in the nose cone.
So Hitler comes to power. That little clip I played just indicative of the sick charisma he had with the German people. I mean, they went wild.
And they did, and you'll see the the films. Lenny Renswall, his last name is hard to pronounce, but one of the great filmmakers was producing these extravaganzas of the Nuremberg rallies and these Triumph of the Will is a 3 or 4 hour long movie of Hitler having one of these hypnotic meetings of hundreds and thousands and thousands of Germans waiting to see him speak. And these are early ideas of how captivating Hitler was over the German people. The initial rise to Hitler, he was loved by the German people, embraced very strongly. There were only a few who resisted Hitler and said the underpinnings of this movement are evil. But in general, that was not recognized in 1933, either in Europe or in the United States.
At what point, Jerry, did he start trying to eradicate the Jews?
It began almost as soon as he became chancellor, starting in 1933. It went through a progression of steps. The first were introducing various laws in Germany to restrict the freedom of Jews. They had various marriage laws. They were geneticists. The Nazis were looking at racial profiling by genetic analysis, mm-hmm. and were trying to identify this is a Jew, by genetic characteristics. And then by 1938, I think it was pretty clear the concentration camps were beginning to be formed. It was becoming harder for Jews to leave Germany. And one of the other great tragedies of World War II, very few countries, including the United States, would accept Jews who were trying to get out of Germany. Had we allowed Jews to come to the United States in the 30s, we could have brought many of the Jews out of Europe. Hitler probably would have sold the Jews to whomever would have paid for them.
Sure.
But again, part of the tragedy is even Great Britain and Winston Churchill worked with Palestine at the time to restrict Jewish immigration to Palestine. The Jews largely were trapped. If Jews had stayed by 1938 in Germany, were increasingly trapped and were going to be facing extermination.
Now, as this is ongoing, and he's beginning to build his concentration camps and his gas chambers, why didn't he just kick them out of Germany if that's what he wanted to do, just to get rid of them? Why did he have to kill them?
Again, George, you're dealing with kind of, you know, a rational question. I mean, first of all, why, you know, the idea of getting rid of the Jews.
And most of these, weren't they born in Germany?
Oh, yes. In fact, many of the Jewish Germans had been distinguished in fighting in World War One. They were war heroes. The Jews had fought valiantly for Germany. They were German. Their history going back, you know, decades, generations of families were German. These were Jews who identified with Deutschland. They were not, you know, they were loyal to Germany. Hitler's insanity, focusing on the Jews, which comes into the category of a mental psychosis, I believe. You know, it's unexplainable any other way. Focused German resources at a time when Hitler was beginning to engage in a war not only in Europe against first Great Britain, but then against Russia in Asia, I mean in Central Asia, and you know, these two front wars. At the same time, Hitler's applying increasing resources to killing Jews, which is insanity.
And he's getting away with it at the time.
Well, and unfortunately, the rest of the world stood by the beginning of the persecution of the Jews. The beginning of the concentration camps was well reported in the United States newspapers at the time.
Nobody believed it, right?
Well, even those who believed it could not get any public sympathy or reaction. The anti-Semitism around the world was, again, at a peak. It was a period of insanity for the world. Had Franklin Roosevelt opened, you know, there's a great episode of the St. Louis, this boat of Jews that tries to emigrate from Europe. They get out of Europe, and then they come to the United States. We won't take them.
They turned it around.
The boat St. Louis returns to Europe. Most of those Jews die in the concentration camps. Tragic story and heartbreaking when you read the details of the families and the people involved. And it's hard to imagine how, you know, cold and cruel even the United States was to close our doors, you know, the Statue of Liberty and the like, and saying, these Jews cannot enter, even though anyone who really understood the situation knew the Jews on the St. Louis were returning to their deaths.
So Hitler talked about Lebensraum, which was living space in German.
Yes.
And he wanted more land. So he goes into Poland to start.
That was one of the big excuses. Of course, Germany has always had territorial ambitions on Poland. Poland's been in dispute between Russia and Germany going back hundreds and hundreds of years. And Hitler finally invades Poland. I believe in September 1938, he invades, and the war begins.
Then he starts occupying most of Europe, right?
And then it began actually before then, because Hitler began making territorial demands on Austria, on Slovakia, Czechoslovakia at the time. I mean, he was trying to grab pieces of land that he said were really German. And, of course, there were these disputes going back in World War One, German land that had been given to the French, et cetera. I mean, there was territorial issues in Europe. But Hitler wanted more living space for the German people, and his idea was to take over these different countries and eliminate the racially inferior people, the Poles, and put Germans into Poland. Again, a lot of the racial ideas, a lot of the genetic ideas, the eugenics that were driving the Nazi ideology are insane and I think very dangerous ideas, which again we saw fully manifested when Hitler began step by step to attack everything in Europe, attack Great Britain, and attack Russia. So Germany was involved very quickly in a war on two fronts, which was, again, insane. At the same time, Germany's increasingly applying resources to exterminate the Jews in Germany and everywhere else they're found.
So during this period, now he's, you know, he's in Europe, he's bombing London, he's into France. Does he make the visit? Are we in it yet before he attacks Russia?
No, Russia was attacked before we were in the war.
Okay.
And we came into the war really in December 1941 when Pearl Harbor was attacked.
We saved it.
Yes, well, people have to understand, first of all, we declared war against Japan and only Japan after Pearl Harbor. Germany had an alliance with Japan, and Germany declared war on the United States. We did not enter the war with Germany initially, even after Pearl Harbor. It took a two-step process. And it was a, you know, there's been enormous discussion and historical research on Hitler, I mean, on Churchill and his relationship with FDR, Franklin Roosevelt, president, because Churchill knew that if the United States did not come into the war, it was only a matter of time before Great Britain would be destroyed by the German war machine. And, of course, Russia also wanted the United States into the war for the same reasons. Germany was a formidable enemy, and the Wehrmacht, the German army, was the most advanced army in the world at the time.
Did Hitler ever visit the United States?
No, Hitler never did. No, he never did. The famous pictures of Hitler in Paris at the Eiffel Tower really were just one day. Hitler flew in and got his picture taken. Hitler spent most of his time in Germany. And Hitler, the other great secret about Hitler is he was really Austrian. He was not German. In fact, probably under German laws, until they were modified, he should never have been chancellor.
Isn't that something? And he was very sickly, wasn't he?
Hitler, yes, and he became more and more sickly as he went along.
Might have had Parkinson's disease.
There's speculation that Hitler had Parkinson's disease. Certainly, after the height of the German advance, by 1943, Hitler's seen fewer and fewer times in public. And by the end of the war, any photographs of him or video, he looks like a sickly old man.
Shaking, everything.
Yes, and there were a couple of attempts to kill Hitler, and one of the last attempts, which was this Operation Valkyrie, the bombing of Hitler's, one of his outposts when he was in a command room with
right.
generals, badly damaged Hitler. He suffered some physical damage to his arm, and he was badly hurt in that bombing. Nearly killed. But Hitler, by the end of his life, and all the video coming out of Germany at the time, looked like a sickly old man.
Well, with Dr. Jerry Corsi, his book, Hunting Hitler, and we're going to get into this hunt in a moment. It's an incredible story. And, Jerry, we've got about a minute before the break, but tell me how you got into this story.
Well, George, I'm always fascinated by stories that involve governments lying to people, the people. And this, as I got into it, and especially with the evidence that the Hitler skull was not his, we'll talk about that, it became to me that this is a case of disinformation saying that Hitler died, concocted by the U.S. and British government, somewhat with the help of the Russian government, and this lie was sold to the world and has been until today. It's a disinformation story of intelligence operations and how they operate. That's what really fascinates me.
Did many people of the time know that Hitler may have escaped?
Yes. Stalin believed that Hitler escaped. He said so many times, I documented in the book. He even told aides to FDR. General Eisenhower went on the record and said that Hitler escaped, and he was recorded in Stars and Stripes, the military newspaper, saying that until Eisenhower was told never to say that again. Those in the know at the end of World War II knew that Hitler's body had not been positively identified, and there was no evidence that he had died.
All right, we're going to get into all of this. Hunting Hitler, Jerry Corsi, our special guest tonight on Coast to Coast AM. By the way, Jerry Corsi was my guest with his work, Who Really Killed Kennedy, on Beyond Belief. And you can watch that incredible program for free. Simply go to the website, beyondbelief.com, and look at all the past programs and look for the one with Jerry Corsi on it. And you'll enjoy it. Beyondbelief.com. And welcome back. Dr. Jerome Corsi with us, Hunting Hitler. So let us go to the beginning of the traditional story that we all think we know, Jerry, about Hitler and his death on April 30th, 1945. What happened?
Well, George, the story is that Hitler is in his Führer bunker in the middle of Berlin by the Reich Chancellery, and he's down underneath the ground in this complex set of underground rooms with Eva Braun, his mistress, long-term mistress, never married her. And then it's approaching April 30th. The Russian army is about to overtake Berlin. And Hitler has got to make a decision, the story goes. And the decision is either he get captured or he has to some way or other get killed. There's no escape route, supposedly, at this point. And Hitler knew that Mussolini and Mussolini's girlfriend had been captured by the Italians in northern Italy and had been strung up, their bodies disgraced in a public ceremony of derision. And Hitler basically said he didn't want to be like a circus monkey around in a cage, mm-hmm. brought around for display, put on trial.
It all makes sense, doesn't it?
Cover stories have got to make sense. They're no good if they don't make sense. And so then the story goes that Hitler, in this elaborate set of ceremonies, first he writes and signs a will. Then he has a ceremony. He actually marries Eva Braun. Then the two of them say goodbye to their staffs in the bunker, and, very tearful and elaborate kind of, but yet very dignified goodbyes. And they go into the private quarters of Hitler in the Führer bunker, and supposedly they have cyanide and pistols. And either through some combination of taking the cyanide and shooting themselves, Hitler and Eva Braun commit suicide, at which point those in the bunker open the private doors to the residence of Hitler in the bunker. They see that they're both dead. The Russian army's been shelling for days this whole Berlin area. The Germans in the bunker, top Nazis and personal aides to Hitler, take the bodies outside the Führer bunker. They put them in shallow ditches, dugout areas, and because everything's bombed out, everything is rubble. They find gasoline, they pour gasoline on the bodies, and they burn and cremate the bodies. And then this area is shelled. They go back into the bunker by May 2nd, 1945. The German have capitulated. The Russian army now has complete control of Berlin, and the Russians are in Berlin looking for Hitler's body. And supposedly discover Hitler and Eva Braun's corpse. And again, how they discovered them is first they find someone who looks exactly like Hitler. Mm-hmm. The Russian army photographs and says, this is Hitler's body. It turns out to be a double. The double had darned socks on and a uniform that was soiled with food. It was also too tall to be Hitler. At any rate, finally, the Russians find two charred bodies, and they say, this is Hitler and Eva Braun. The Russian army takes the bodies away, and the Russian military authorities begin the process of conducting an autopsy.
Okay, so all this is going on. At what point does someone say, we didn't hear shots, we didn't hear any of this?
Almost from the very beginning, George, people like Stalin and Eisenhower and others in the know are saying there's something fishy about this because there's no clear identification of a body and there's no photographs of the bodies having been shot or the assassin, the suicide that they went through. So the physical evidence, positive identification is very, very weak, and it's compared to Goebbels and his wife and their children were also in the bunker, and they, as a family, committed suicide, and those bodies are all found and positively identified. So the question is, why is the Goebbels family positively identified, and yet Hitler and Eva Braun are supposedly nowhere to be found? And with the body that is produced by the Russians take away very quickly, and they don't let anybody see. So there's no physical evidence. There's no satisfying proof that, the world knows that this is Hitler because you've got the body and you can make positive identifications one way or another of the body to be Hitler. It's indisputable. Instead, the body's gone, there's no pictures, there's no evidence, and no one can identify it, and pretty quickly the stories start to be conflicting.
Now, he was apparently gasolined, right? Cremated,
yes.
At least that's what he wanted. What happened to the bones, the skeleton?
Well, again, first of all, you've got all this rubble outside the bunker, and it's being shelled.
It's a war zone.
It's a war zone, and there's bodies everywhere. There's not just one or two bodies, and there's body pieces everywhere. And, this is an active war zone with casualties, including civilian casualties, and finding bodies. The Russians come in May 2nd. And they're at the Fuhrer bunker, and they're looking for the body. Pretty quickly, Russian intelligence officers take over. And they say, okay, we're in charge. A guy named Klemenko, who was one of the top Russian colonels, lieutenant colonels. He was commander of the counterintelligence section of the 79th Rifle Corps of the 3rd Shock Army. That's the Russian army that was in Berlin first. Klemenko and some of his aides get a jeep and they go looking for Hitler's body. They first find this double. They're very suspicious of the double. They take the double and put him over in the Reichschancellery. And then somebody says, wait a minute, I think we found the corpse over here. They find another two bodies and it buried. And so they start digging up these other two bodies. They say, well, we think this is Hitler. And so that goes through another process. One of the platoon soldiers, a guy named Ivan, digs up these bodies. And the Russians like this because they said Ivan came to Berlin to find Hitler. His name was Ivan Chirikov. He digs up these two body parts. They haul these body parts away in crates. They're badly charred. They don't know for sure what they've got, and these are the two bodies. Faces not recognizable.
Can't even tell if it's male or female.
Barely. I mean, they think they've got one male, one female. They don't know who the two bodies are. They don't have the whole bodies. They found the skulls some 30 or 40 feet below the level where they found the bodies. They're basically just picking up body parts and random corpses and saying, here's Hitler and Eva Braun. When you read the accounts, and now the Russian accounts are available, and I would, relied very heavily on a book done by a Russian intelligence officer in 1968. His name was Lev Bezmensky, and he was one of the intelligence officers in the general staff of General Zhukov, who was the general of the Russian army in charge of taking Berlin. And in 1968, he wrote a book called The Death of Hitler, Unknown Documents from the Soviet Archives. It was the first time the West had a look at the internal documents, 1968, from 1945, so almost a quarter century later. And what this intelligence officer, Bezmensky, published was an account of how the Russian intelligence officers and army discovered these two bodies, charred, unrecognizable. But finally, they said, these are Hitler and Eva Braun. They box them up in ammunition crates, and they take them away.
Now, there's been some DNA testing done here, right?
This was what really, George, got me deeply into this. This is the key turning point. There was even a History Channel special done on this called Hitler's Escape in 2009. This DVD. A scientist, a guy named Bellatoni, Nicholas Bellatoni, who was a state archaeologist in Connecticut. He was given permission, 2009, to view the remains that the Russians had in the Russian archives in Moscow of these Hitler skull fragments. And Bellatoni, being a well-trained scientist, a true professional, filmed his ability to get in and look at these skull fragments. Mm-hmm. He went in with rubber gloves, and he took blood samples with cotton swabs, and he
did it all right.
All right. Photographed the skull, examined the skull, took samples from the skull for DNA testing. Remarkably, the Russians let him scrape pieces out of this skull off and take them away. And Bellantoni's there. He's saying, you know, this doesn't look right. The sutures on this skull, if a human skull has lines of sutures, zigzag lines, where the different plates come together. And on a younger person, those sutures are open more. The skull fuses together in an older person. And so he said, this skull looks like a 40-year-old or so. It's too young. And it's too small. Well, when Bellantoni brought the skull back, he went to the University of Connecticut Center for Applied Genetics and Technology, which, again, is a top DNA laboratory. And a molecular biologist, Dr. Linda Strausbaugh, Strausbaugh, who is the director of this university center, supervised the DNA testing, and they said the Hitler skull belonged to a 40-year-old woman whose identity was unknown.
Now, how old was Eva Braun?
Well, Eva Braun was a little bit younger. She was in the right age, but this was identified as not to be her skull at all.
Okay,
because when they took a look, she was 33 years old, Eva Braun, in April 1945.
Gosh, and he was 56.
And he was 56.
He went after a young one.
Well, yes, he did. And, the other problem with the Eva Braun identification of the skull was that the Hitler's Eva Braun, there was no evidence that she actually shot herself. In fact, the Russian autopsy said she died from cyanide. Now, this is part of the difficulty. There's very conflicting stories, but the skull they're looking at of this 40-year-old woman clearly had gunshot wounds in it. So it was clear that when the Russians picked up a skull, they got a skull that had been shot through the head. So they did that much right. But the skull was a 40-year-old woman, was not Hitler's, and it was not Eva Braun's because, A, it was too old for Eva Braun, and, B, Eva Braun probably did not shoot herself.
Jeez. All right, so they do all this checking. They said, look, this is not Hitler.
Right, so suddenly, I mean, Bellantoni is saying this is the whole point of this 2009 this Mystery Quest Hitler Escape documentary on the History Channel. I'm watching it, and I'm saying, wait a minute, because I'd read all about this Hitler skull. I'd seen it. You know, I've said, okay, if they got the Hitler skull and they did an autopsy, it's got to have been Hitler and Eva Braun. Like everybody else, I went along with the story. But as soon as I saw Bellantoni, and I called Bellantoni, I interviewed Bellantoni. You know, I'm a journalist. I'm not just going to rely on the History Channel special, as good as it was. Bellantoni told me, yeah, it's all true. He said, you know, he about fell off his chair when he looked at the DNA results. But he said the DNA results were consistent with his own inspection of the skull and saying it's too small. And it belongs to a younger person than Hitler. So it was probably a woman and probably younger. And the DNA confirms it's not Hitler. So Bellantoni says, we got to go back to square one. This evidence the Russians have had since the end of World War II, 1945, to prove that Hitler turned out to be somebody else's skull, a woman.
Okay, now, let's go back to 45 or so. The war's getting close to ending.
Right.
Who knew what?
Well, see, we're the disinformation starts because you've got a problem here. That is that Hitler's gone. Nobody knows where he is. The body's gone. Now, you can't admit, if you want to admit you let Hitler escape, you know, you got a lot of people mad at you. I mean, Russia's got a problem. They've got, there were close to 60 million people killed by Hitler.
That's right.
And, you know, the world wanted
his head.
They wanted justice. They wanted Hitler brought to justice. And so, you know, the British intelligence, the U.S. intelligence have a problem. They don't have – the Russians are not letting them see the bodies that they have of Hitler's corpse and Eva Braun's corpse. The ones they're saying are the corpses. So what the British intelligence does is they go in to get a young – history graduate student from Oxford, a guy named Trevor Roper. And this guy, Trevor Roper, has an intelligence background, and they all think, well, he's going to be a great guy to come in and write the Hitler story. And they bring in Trevor Roper from Great Britain, and he comes into Germany, and he's supposed to then write this definitive book of Hitler's demise. Now, Trevor Roper, when he gets there, and first of all, you know, he writes the book, and he tells the story we just told about how it was this double suicide, Hitler and Eva Braun in the bunker. All the Germans say goodbye. They take the bodies out. They burn them in the garden of the Führer bunker, and they all salute and goodbye, and they go back in the bunker while it's being shelled. That's the story Trevor Roper tells. Now, the problem is that Trevor Roper, I found in the archives, within 10 days of the time that Trevor Roper is there, U.S. intelligence is already writing his conclusions. But it was shocking. I'm coming across this document, and I'm saying, wait a minute.
Where have we heard this before, huh?
Yeah, exactly. And I'm reading this document from a U.S. intelligence officer at the end of World War II. I look at the dates of the document. It's like about only 10 days after Trevor Roper gets on the scene. And the U.S. intelligence officers are step-by-step laying out the course of what Trevor Roper's conclusions are going to be. And they've got the whole story scripted. Now, then I say, wait a minute, but Trevor Roper said he interviewed all the witnesses in the bunker. And it turns out, no, the Russians had most of the witnesses already in Russian captivity, and they were back in Moscow. And the Russians gave Trevor Roper no access to any of the German witnesses in the Führer bunker that had been captured by the Russian army. And the American army had the others in captivity in the Führer bunker, and Trevor Roper was only allowed to read their signed statements.
Now, didn't Stalin believe, Jerry, that Hitler had escaped?
Oh, yeah. Stalin said from the very beginning. In fact, the file, when we finally got to look at the file that Stalin had created on Hitler and Eva Braun, called Operation Myth, because Stalin said it was a myth that Hitler was killed. Stalin rebuked his generals, even Zhukov. He dressed him down for saying that Hitler was killed and they knew it. Stalin said Hitler got away. And Stalin told the top advisors for FDR, before FDR died, you know, Stalin was suspicious this was going to happen before FDR died. And then when Truman came in, Stalin said, you guys, you the Americans, helped Hitler escape. He got away, and he got away because your intelligence agents, Alan Dulles and Bern, Switzerland.
Well, they were Nazi supporters for a while, weren't they?
Well, yes. In fact, the story of before World War II was that the Dulles family, John Foster Dulles, who became Secretary of State under Eisenhower, and Alan Dulles, the head of the CIA under Eisenhower, were working for investment banking firm Brown Brothers Harriman, Averell Harriman's family, together with two of the progenitors of the Bush dynasty.
That's right.
Prescott Bush and George Herbert Walker were also part of this firm, and they were financing the Nazis. In fact, the Bushes were running a Nazi bank along with the Dulleses in New York, called Union Bank, that FDR closed down about 7 months after Pearl Harbor, and it was even noticed in the New York Times. I mean, it's all in the public
record.
What
an amazing story. Well, Jerry, stay with us. Already hour one of three gone. We're going to come back with more. Dr. Jerome Corsi, Hunting Hitler. We're going to get into more things about what Stalin believed, and if this is all true, where did Hitler end up going? Who helped him go? How did he get to wherever he went? We'll be back.